So, Saturday night at Abhayagiri. Ajahn Yanako asked me to give the Saturday night Dhamma talk a few days ago. And I don't usually give Dhamma talks, being quite junior. We give, all of us, the whole community, give a reflection on Purana Day at the end of the Vasa, the rains retreat. That's just 5 or 10 minutes. So it's been interesting to watch my mind the last few days. When I remember that I'm going to give a talk tonight, one quote that kept arising here and there, I don't know who said it, but it's something like, there's nothing that focuses a man's mind so wonderfully as knowing that he's headed to the guillotine in 2 weeks' time. And I've never been in that position, fortunately, but there's this interesting similarity here where, I don't know, it kind of puts you in check a little bit. All right, you know, I'm going to have the mic for a few minutes and been in robes for a little while. Am I worthy of speaking on this topic? Questions like that. Reflecting. So it's good, it's very valuable. Ajahn Shah was known to use the putting people in this position to give a Dhamma talk, not necessarily because they're the right person for the job or they had some, you know, sparkling insight to be shared with everybody, but as a teaching tool to show the student themselves. And my favorite stories about that are the Ajahn Sumedho stories. The one, and I, in my mind, it somehow was an 8-hour Dhamma talk, but I think it actually might have only been 3. But Ajahn Sumedho was given the Dhamma talk on a Wanpra, I believe. And he gave a talk, and it was like a half hour, maybe 40 minutes, and Ajahn Shah was like, okay, good, keep going. And I think Ajahn Sumedho did another half hour and was gradually running out of things to talk about. And it was in Thai also. And by the end of it, people were just lying down. He was just saying words. And Ajahn Sumedho said he lost the fear of boring people after that. It was such a powerful experience. And Ajahn Sumedho also would talk about his own self-consciousness. He's someone who gives, in his talks, he's so open about his own foibles as a young man, as a young monk. And for me, it's extra inspiring to see that in contrast to where he is now, my own perception of where he is now. Speaking about how self-conscious he was. Or seeing that in his early years as a monk, seeing these parts of his personality that he'd never really seen before. Like, he always thought he was a really nice guy. And he saw these really kind of nasty parts of himself coming up. Real angry, real nasty, and I think a lot of us can relate to that. We're put inside this container, this pressure cooker, and so many of the things that we relied upon, crutches, defenses, are stripped from us. We have to have the same haircut as everybody else, wear the same clothes. We're told what to do at many hours of the day. We're not choosing who we're hanging out with. by choice, obviously, all of this, but nonetheless, it brings up a lot of stuff by design. And we don't have all the things that we had before to turn to deal with the pain and all these different parts of ourselves that we'd rather not come into contact with. And so the only option at the end of the day is to turn to the Dhamma. We have one another, and that's important, it's crucial. But that in itself is not enough. So we intentionally, voluntarily put ourselves in this position. No way out. And we have to develop Dhamma, it's sink or swim. When the anger arises, you have to develop equanimity, loving kindness, compassion. Because there's nowhere else to turn. It's intentionally frustrating. The rock tumbler. We're here with each other. Bumping up against each other, bashing into each other, doing our best not to, but it's inevitable. And honestly, it also works in the end. Soften our rough edges, and people get softer over time. We learn over time. We get better over time at doing it, like with anything. But it seems like it takes a long time for most of us. There's the famous Ajahn Ajalo story that he tells about, I think he was like 5 Vasa, and just going through a real rough spell and not seeing a lot of hope. And he was at Wat Mobjan, and Ajahn Anand is the teacher there, still is. And he ran into him on the trail, and he kneeled before him, and he said, "Oh, Ajahn, is it ever going to get any easier?" And Ajahn Anand smiled, and he looked at me and said, "Yeah, 5 years, it'll get a little easier." And then 5 years after that, it'll get a little easier, a little better. And that, you can hold that in different ways, you know. You could say, well, that's really depressing. I don't know if I want to sign up for that. But when you're in it and you're doing this, it's in accordance with reality. That's kind of how it is. It does get better. But not on our schedule. We're taught to get satisfaction instantaneously. And in so many things we can. You know, you order something from Amazon, I think the drone now shoots it to your house in 5 minutes. But it doesn't work like that with this. And Ajahn Jayasaro, when he was here one time, said something like, in the world, something like, in the world you live your life and things get worse. But in the monastery, things get better as you get older. Which I guess you just have to chew on and hope that it's true. The latter half, anyway. And one time I heard Ajahn Panyavado say about the practice, he said, quite simply, he said, "It's not easy. It's difficult." And at the time, that was not comforting. It was kind of a letdown. I was like, oh, really? But then over time, I've turned to that simple statement again and again and found solace in it, comfort, that like, okay, this is difficult. I'm having a rough time here, and that's okay. That's normal. That's in accordance with reality. That's not something special just for me. Things are difficult. That is the deal. It was difficult for them. It was difficult for Ajahn Mahabua. It was difficult for Ajahn Chah. And if it's difficult for them, it's okay if it's difficult for me and it's difficult for the rest of us. Something about it being normal, the difficulty, the fact that it takes time, makes it so much easier to be with. Like being on an airplane and experiencing turbulence and them, the stewardess saying, well, no, don't worry about it, or the pilot, it's just turbulence, it's normal, it happens, don't worry about it, don't sweat it, relax. It's par for the course. And we have to find these upaya, these skillful means, we have to find them for ourselves. What's going to work? Through trial and error. Through trying it for ourselves, knowing for ourselves. And certainly, the Buddha lays out a whole bunch of recommendations in the suttas. And the teachers in our tradition do the same. But at the end of the day, you have to try it for yourself to know if it works or not. Try the breath. Try the body. Try the asubha. Try the kindness. Not only that, but you have to figure out how to do it for yourself. What image, what phrase, what object gives rise to feelings of loving kindness in your heart? Like, you're the instrument, your heart, your mind is the instrument, and you have to learn how to play it. And no one else can do it for you. It's also very empowering, the teaching. Because it says that the cause of dukkha is craving, greed, hatred, and delusion. And that's something that you can do something about. It doesn't say the cause of dukkha is the person sitting next to you. The cause of dukkha is the way that the world is. It says the cause of dukkha is the way that you're relating to it, how you're seeing it. And you can do something about that. And it may take a while, but it's doable. And in fact, it's the only thing that's worth doing. When I was in Anagarika, Ajahn Viradhamo visited, and I was going through my own stuff, and he was a Padimokkha, Awada, reflection, and he gave a short one, but one thing he said was, stick with it, it's worth it. What else are you going to do? And whether your container's monastic and it's the 227 precepts or it's the 5 precepts in the world, it's still the same practice. You still have to turn to the same reflections and methods to soothe the heart, to calm the heart. So you find which container works for you. And go with that. Commit yourself to that. And as Westerners, we're pretty well grounded in the Judeo-Christian model. We're very strong in generalizing, of course, but we're very strong in critical thinking. From a young age, we're sort of have that drilled into us. And it's not the same in all cultures in the world. And, you know, there's these famous stories of Thai masters or Tibetan masters having to be explained to them what guilt is. They just no concept of it. But I'm sure everyone in this room is pretty well versed in guilt, judgment, criticism. And like anything, there's pros and cons. Like Ajahn Viradamo said, you're not trying to throw out the critical mind. You're trying to balance it out because we need it. Because if we didn't have critical mind, we'd be outside eating dirt, you know. So it's crucial, but if it's out of control, if it's out of whack, we're going to be in bad shape inside and with others. And so it's not all of us. Some of us, you know, if you've got more of a sensual bent, more of a greed bent, more of a positive bent, you're probably a pretty good candidate for the Asubha practice. Focusing on the more unattractive aspects of the body, food. And if it leads to calm, if it's cooling to the heart, then it's good and it's right and you should keep doing it. But if you're doing those practices and you're seeing it leading to increased negativity, increased sort of bleakness, blackness, darkness, depression, then it might be good to try the old loving kindness meditation, because that's going to be right for a lot of us, not as the only thing, but as one of the things, one of the tools in our tool belt. I found it so important for me, so central. Something that Ajahn Pasana has emphasized and reminded me and I think all of us over the years. And when I forget and then remember again, it's so obvious. I can see where my mind sort of kind of turning the wrong way. And I've known monks too, you know. There's a lot of attractive aspects of our tradition, sort of spiritual warrior, Tudong, and tough and strong. And we have a rich history and a rich tradition. But if you grab onto those things without that foundation of kindness and softness, generosity and forgiveness and compassion, it's not enough. You'll harden and you'll dry up and you'll crack and you'll break. And so many of these great Thai masters teaching these kinds of methods and practices, they're teaching a people, again generalizing, that, as Ajahn Pasana has said, are extraordinarily mellow. If you spent time with Thai people, like, there's a real brightness and joy and a generosity, and that's not always the case. It is with some Westerners, but we We can generalize a little bit. The cultures aren't exactly the same. So we have to learn how to give rise to these things inside of ourselves. Joy and levity, lightness. There's a balance, you know. Obviously we don't want to just be running around being foolish and frivolous. But we've got to find that balance. The middle way. And it's been my great privilege to live here at this monastery for most of the last 10 years. And one of the wonderful things about this monastery is the tone, the emotional tone of it, the feel of it, that's been set by Ajahn Amaro and Ajahn Pasano 25 years ago, and then continued by Ajahn Pasano as a soul abbot, which is most of the time that I was here, and then continued by Ajahn Krunadamo and Ajahn Yanako, and now continued by Ajahn Yanako, and it's the same tone I've found. That feel has been maintained, and it's good, and it's a huge blessing, and it's been a huge blessing for me. And it's not the only one, but I feel it's a really, really good one, especially for Westerners. There's a warmth and a lightness and an emphasis on communal harmony and working together and working stuff out if you got problems with somebody else, placing a value on that. Not just saying, well, you know, it's a solo trip and I'm here to do my practice, which I think a lot of us think, perhaps in the beginning, I certainly did. I thought it was about me, maybe a teacher. And I didn't have any sense of just how important the communal practice was and is. And just how much I had and still have to learn. From learning how to live with other people and get along with other people. It's just classic relationship stuff, compromise and forgiveness and patience, kindness, small gestures of kindness and respect. And we receive feedback from one another, both from the Ajahns and the more junior community, sometimes in direct and sometimes in indirect ways. And the Buddha said someone pointing out a flaw or a fault to you is like finding gold. And it doesn't feel very good. No one, I doubt there's anyone who likes it. But it's almost always beneficial. And there's almost always at least a grain of truth to it, if not like completely true and accurate. That's part of the communal practice, experience. And Ajahn Chah said you should make your practice like a circle, continuous, unbroken. And I kind of see that relating to how we learn how to practice, how to be alone, up in the forest, in our hut. And then come down the hill and learn how to be with everybody else. And somehow maintain a continuity between the two. And learn both skills. I think some of us, would much rather be in activity, be around other people. And there's some of us that can't wait to get back to our huts, be alone. But here and in the Ajahn Chah monasteries, there's an emphasis on learning both and being able to do both. Another thing that comes to mind, in a similar topic, is like views and opinions. I've heard Ajahn Pasano say that people in the world tend to get into disputes about material possessions, whereas monastics tend to get into disputes about views and opinions. And it's interesting when you strip so much stuff away, how important these things become. But then at the same time, in the world right now, it's kind of a problem there too, views and opinions. So it's not solely a monastic affliction. So how do we learn how to hold on to these things skillfully? Not get bent out of shape if somebody thinks something different than we do, or if a teacher says this, or learning how to relate to things skillfully, including the Dhamma, including the practice, including the Vinaya. I think at first I didn't realize that it wasn't enough simply to practice. It wasn't enough to simply live in the monastery, but you have to apply the Dhamma to the Dhamma. You can't just hold the Vinaya, you can't just keep the Vinaya. You have to relate to it skillfully. In addition to following the rules, you have to relate to them skillfully, meaning like have a sense of dispassion about it, coolness, equanimity about it. Because it's so easy to fall into worry and anxiety and fear around rules and morality. Or to completely flip out about the practice itself, the Noble Eightfold Path and death and karma and rebirth. Just totally lose your mind. Just sheer panic about the whole situation. And that's not skillful. So it's very, very good to have faith in these things. But it's not enough. I went to the dentist last week. And interestingly, something that was happening with my teeth, the dentist said I was flossing too hard, brushing my teeth too hard. It's like I'm doing the right things. We're very, very diligent here about our teeth care. No one takes care of their teeth better than monastics. But it kind of was like, well, that's interesting, isn't it? It's not enough to do the right thing. You got to do it right. With a light touch. You have to find the right amount of pressure. So I've followed what the dentist said the last 5 to 8 or so, and it's working. It's helping. That's reassuring. We've got to find these things for ourselves. Find what works for ourselves. And we got a lot of options. Different books by different teachers. And if you find something that works for you, that's it. There's no need to think about it anymore or going to doubt if somebody else is saying that they don't like such and such a teacher or such and such a method. If it works for you, you can just keep quiet and know that it works for you. And if you find talking about your practice helpful, that's great. You can talk to people about your practice. And certainly the Buddha spoke highly about talk on the Dhamma. But if you find that talking about your practice doesn't help so much, that maybe you go into doubt a little bit when you hear other people talking about their practice, that's okay too. Friend of mine in the world, I remember she, I guess, had some sort of guru, her family, when she was little, and he gave her a mantra. And he said, you can't ever tell anybody your mantra. It's for you only. And then I promptly asked her what her mantra was. She didn't tell me, which, you know, right on. It's important to develop this personal relationship with all these things. Personal relationship with the Buddha, with the Dhamma, with the Sangha. Personal connection. In our huts, we all have our own altars. You need to find those things that speak to you, that resonate with you. Those practices that work for you. And it becomes real stark, you know, in the monastery when you're alone in your hut at night or during the day, you know, the kilesas don't care what time it is. And you get hit by a wave of fear or anxiety or whatever it is. And you need to have your own toolkit, your own personal medicine chest, methods that work for you, that you can depend on. Be a light unto yourself. And it does get better in time. It just does. It's like anything. If you stick with it, and I get a lot of hope from the people that I've lived with here over the last 10 years. I can see the progress in them. It's very inspiring. You see people change. You see people learn. You see people get better, soften, or strengthen. And then on top of that, you got people like Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Pasano. I didn't know them when they were young, but I've heard them say things about how they were when they were young, and it's not the way they are now. It's like testimonials. I did it. It worked for me. And that's why I turned to monasticism in the first place. It was meeting Ajahn Panyavado, and he was the first person I'd ever met who seemed to have some idea of what was happening, who seemed happy and calm and at peace. And it was that very simple thought of, well, I don't have any better ideas, and this worked for him. And the few glimmers that I've had in my own meditation suggest things that are only possible in here and that I've never felt anywhere else. So I get a lot from the teachers in our tradition. Faith. So I wish everybody the best with your practice, and I hope you found or find those things that work for you, that lead to the cessation of suffering, both in the day in the day to day and in the end, in total liberation. I think I'll leave it there for now.